access your number 28888 Real One.
It ensured that supplies from the States, ammunition, munitions, tanks, and food, especially for the people in the country, if it the Navy hadn't done, you know, the convoy from the States and to battle the U-boats, plus our squadrons. We were the only Liberator squadron at the time to fight the U-boat, and it really saved England. Churchill did say that he was most worried about this feature, and he thought the Battle of the Atlantic was highly important for the survival of the country.
And of course it was said that an aircraft couldn't sink a U-boat, but you proved to to the administration, to the powers that be, that was wrong.
That's true. Of course, I changed the method of attack. That was one of the reasons that we were so successful against the U-boat, because the Air Ministry initially told us to, once we sighted a U-boat, just go straight for it. And at any angle. But I proved that was useless, because in a stick of depth charges, we had 6 or 8 depth charges. Yep. And it was far better to, you get more lethal at an angle of about 20, 25 degrees across the line of the U-boat's hull.
Yes.
Its track. You get more depth charges closer to the U-boat. In fact, you get almost at least 3 or 4 out of the 6.
And, of course, your results proved that to be
correct. Absolutely.
Let's go back to the beginning, because at school, your brother, your father had been very much into, shall we say, entertaining, into music. You became the pipe major. And you developed an interest in flying, I think, through a lecture at school.
That's true. First of all, my father was in the BBC in Belfast for quite a number of years. Before that, he was in the linen industry. At Campbell College, a wing commander from RAF Station Aldergrove came and gave us a lecture with lantern slides. That was the height of the
technology.
Technology at that time, to interest us into the Air Force, coming into the Air Force. Finally, at the end, he asked if any of the boys would like to go have a flight in one of his old Vickers Virginias, which was a 4-engine and old biplane, used to fly at about 90 knots.
A 4-engine biplane?
Yeah.
Goodness.
Twin engine.
Twin engine, yeah.
So I put my hand up. being me, I thought it would be great fun.
Yep.
So eventually I got he organized a flight for me in a Vickers Virginia up at Aldergrove. And that made me absolutely certain that I wanted to go into the Air Force.
Yes, and that
which I did.
Yes, and of course, then the idea would have been to go to the RAF College at Cranwell, but sadly, initially, that wasn't to be. You didn't pass the test entirely.
Oh, I passed all the exams, but it was on medical grounds.
Yes,
that they failed me. I had a swollen gland here in my neck, and they wouldn't let me go to Cranwell. So I said, well, the hell with them. And I put in for a short service commission, which I got straight away.
Yes. And where did your flying training then begin?
Well, first of all, I was at Prestwick in Scotland with Scottish Aviation, which is really a civilian outfit. But they were manned by RAF instructors. That was in the winter of from November 1936 through the winter. We used to do PT, running down the road outside Press Victoria in the middle of winter.
Oh, lovely.
Oh. In shorts, yes. And a vest.
Gosh.
We had to be tough in those days.
Yes.
And then after that, we got through the course, and I went to Netherhaven, RAF station Netherhaven in Salisbury Plain. That was quite a tough course. We were flying on Hawker Hearts and Hawker Audax, which was a biplane with Rolls-Royce Kestrel engines. Well, it was lovely flying those things. We used to air about them.
Gosh, because you proved to be marked up as being an excellent navigator, but of course became a pilot.
Well, both really.
Yes, yeah, sure. Yeah. And so where did you go from then? Because this was still pre-war, wasn't it?
This was 1937.
The halcyon days, I think it's
absolutely
described.
And 1937, I went to join 206 Squadron at Bertram Newton in Norfolk, which was a lovely station. Well, a pre-war station. In fact, it was a First World War station originally. And we had a great time in Norfolk. And we flew the Anson there.
That was my first
squadron, yeah. And I enjoyed that. We were doing cross-country flights and flights across the North Sea to Holland, triangular ones, and back again. And it was great.
And then you became involved in collecting aircraft, Hudsons, and eventually Liberators, almost a ferry pilot.
Well, yes, indeed. That was after my first rest period, because we'd been flying Hudsons. Our Hudsons replaced the Anson. And in the summer of 1940, we were bombing the harbours in Western Europe, all down the Dutch and French harbours, where the Germans had their barges for the invasion of Britain. We were bombing these at night.
When you were flying Ansons, I mean, as I remember, that's a fairly sort of slow aircraft.
Very slow.
Not exactly fighter aircraft maneuverability. Did you feel, you must have felt very vulnerable, I should think.
Well, we didn't think about it those days. Oh, we were all quite young.
Yes.
And we enjoyed the flying.
But what about all the flights? You did more flights than anybody else. I know in the book it says you'd because you were becoming very well respected, you'd say to your colleagues, "Oh, I'll take your flight today." And you were up there more hours than anybody else. And I think one day 17 hours?
Oh, that was on a Liberator.
Yeah.
In the North Atlantic when we were up in Iceland. We used to fly down. This was in 1942. On the Liberators, I had a detachment up in Reykjavik, and we used to go right down south of Greenland, right into what they call the Gap in the North Atlantic, where all the German U-boats were gathering to attack the SL and HX convoys from New York and Halifax, Nova Scotia, coming across to the UK.
And very successfully.
Well, yes, you could say that. Mind you, we had quite a help, because we knew where the U-boats were, more or less, because of the Bletchley.
Mm-hmm, yep.
Up there, the decoding station.
Same thing, yes.
One day I attacked 7 U-boats.
Was that the day to remember?
I ran out of... Yes, it was.
Yeah.
I ran out of depth charges, unfortunately. I made 2 attacks. I sank one with 6 depth charges. And that left 2. So then I attacked another one with 2 depth charges. The result was anybody's guess.
Yes.
Nothing happened, really. Just frightened them, I think. And they submerged.
the Coastal Command began to work very much with Royal Navy. And I think you sort of announced your presence the first time, or the first trips, in a fairly startling way, which was not exactly appreciated.
No, the Navy, the Royal Navy thought they owned us. And they gave us tasks to do. They were based in the big headquarters of Liverpool at 15 Group. And they decided what they wanted us to do. But, well, we did what they wanted to do, but we didn't acknowledge the Navy as very good and much good.
But I believe you announced your arrival on the scene in a fairly startling way, much to their annoyance. With HMS Nelson?
Oh, that was before the war.
Was it?
That was on Anson's. And my squadron, which is 206 squadron, we were based down in the West Country on exercises with the Home Fleet down the southwestern approaches. And we flew down there. I discovered the HMS Nelson, and I flew right across its foredeck at about 100 feet and dropped an aluminium sea marker on the deck. And boy, did I ever hear about that afterwards. The Navy were furious.
Mind you, having said that, I think at that time you were pilot officer. Very shortly after that event, they promoted you to flying officer.
Yes, that's true. But the Navy were really upset. But we had a good laugh out of that.
And while we're talking about things like that, of course, you didn't suffer fools gladly and didn't think much of those in authority, particularly a certain military policeman.
Oh, that was up in Reykjavik in Iceland when I was based there. We were having a few drinks in the Borg Hotel, I think it was, my crew. And this military policeman got a bit stroppy. He was a major. He started to give a stick, you know. So we picked him up and threw him out into the lake.
Directly. I guess he wasn't too pleased.
Well, we never saw him after that. We don't know what happened to him. Yeah. But I had to go. The AOC of Iceland, he had me up the next day. And he gave me a bit of a bollocking. But he also smiled and laughed.
I can imagine.
He thought it was quite amusing.
Yes.
So that was the last I heard of the episode.
Yes. Now, if you like more serious note, today we take radar very much for granted. But you were very much involved in the development of it. It was then called ASV, wasn't it?
Air Shipping. Mm. It was ASV, Mark 1, 2 and 3. We had the Mark 3. ASV wasn't much good. We had that on the Hudson's. But you needed a lot of imagination to see if you could find something on the screen.
But you had an excellent crew, particularly.
Oh, yeah, I did. Sure.
A very good air gunner, who's Jock McCall.
Jock McCall, yes, well, he was jack of all trades, really. He was a flight engineer. Mm-hmm. He used to load the cannons down below the flight deck. We had four cannons on the Mark 1 lib, and when we used those, we used to load them up with these canisters, and I used to fire them at the U-boats after we dropped the depth charges. And he did everything. He fixed up our food, which was pretty grotty, from tins of stuff. He used to heat up on a sort of paraffin stove, which they gave us. And he was an air gunner as well.
Paraffin stove in an aircraft, very good, yes. Yes. And of course, you did, as we say, I think one day 17 hours. I mean, today's pilots will think, yes, a long time. But of course, one has to remember also, not only was it a long time, there was no heating, was there, in the Liberators and so on?
Not really. There was a certain amount of heat. But we had to wear our full flying gear and boots and everything, flying boots. And there really wasn't any heat at all. And if you wanted to go to the loo, you had to walk right back to the rear of the aircraft, across a tiny little passageway about this wide, about 6 inches wide, in the Bombay area, to get to the rear of the airplane. But there was no rest period at all, no rest facilities. Yeah. You had to sit in your seat the whole time on the flight deck.
Your amazing score in terms of U-boats, etc., was obviously very much to do with your skill, but also your eyesight was probably considerably better than most people, most of your colleagues.
Well, they did say that my eyesight was exceptional, but I thought everybody, they had to learn how to scan, look for these U-boats on the surface, scanning from left to right and down. A lot of people couldn't be bothered to do that.
And
I did.
And was that because you proved it so well?
Oh,
was
absolutely.
That policy then
that
adopted?
That was adopted, yes.
Became the way one had to do it.
In the VLR squadrons.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And because you were DSO bar DFC bar squadron leader, and you were offered promotion, but that wasn't going to be for you, was it?
No, I had a bit of a row about that. They offered me the command of the squadron, which, being a wing commander, he just pushes paper around his desk, and he didn't have a crew of his own. I said, that's not for me. So I upset them at Coastal Command. I wanted to stay flying, so they let me do that. But I remained a squadron leader for the rest of my existence in the Air Force.
And at the end of the war, you decided not to stay, but to join BOAC.
BOAC, yes. Yeah, well, I did that. I got demobbed one day, and the next day I was in BOAC as a junior captain, because I'd done more flying hours on Liberators, which North Atlantic Ferry Command and BOAC were flying Liberators. But I had more time on the Liberator than they had, so I had no trouble getting in. And I also had my first-class navigator's license, which was essential in those days. You didn't have any of these fancy black boxes.
No.
You know, they just pressed
buttons. It was real navigation.
Yeah. Yeah, indeed.
Yes. And how long did you stay with BOAC?
Or as
It became BA, yes, of course.
25 years
yes.
in there flying, which I enjoyed very much.
Because the other side of your life, we must mention, of course, the other love in your life, apart from Linda, of course, is golf. You played that right from a boy, because your father played golf, didn't he?
My father was an excellent golfer, Malone Golf Club.
And your mother? Did she?
My mother played golf.
Yes.
Yes, she did. Well, we all played golf, my sister and my brother and me. I started when I was 7. It was interrupted, of course, by the war. I hardly ever had a club in my hand for 5 years or thereabouts.
Really? Yes. Mm.
But then I got back to it, and in British Airways, on when I was not on duty, I used to play a lot of golf.
And of course, you still do today, as you live here. Your favourite club, Denham, I mean, we're not very far from that here.
No, we're about 10 miles from Denham, and I was a member there. I joined there in 1952, and which is what, 60 years ago almost, one of the oldest and longest serving members
yes.
in the club.
And of course you still maintain your RAF contacts with the squadron meetings and so on.
Oh, indeed. Yes, I went to Westminster Abbey a couple of years ago when the Coastal Command commemoration service was going on, and I've also been to Kinloss for 120 Squadron, who are based there now. They're still there. Mm-hmm. And various other RAF things. And I belong to the local British Legion, the RAFA branch.
Because what I must ask you, finally, of course, your book, the book Coastal Ace, is not an autobiography. It's written by Tony Spooner. Was he a colleague of yours during those days? Or?
Yes, I knew him in the Air Force, and also he was in BOAC as well.
Yes.
So we were friends.
And you're pleased with the book?
Oh, yes. I like the book.